38. Perhaps they will come home tonight. Rosa Oldsmith looked up from the child's smock she was embroidering. Tonight or tomorrow or the next day, Nanny replied philosophically. There is no profit in guessing at the coming or going of men. They all have worms in their heads. And she began again to rock the cradle, squatting beside it on the leopard-skin rugs, like an animated mummy. The child snuffled a little in its sleep. I'm sure it will be tonight. I can feel it. Something good is going to happen. Rosa laid aside her sewing and crossed to the door that led out onto the stoop. In the last few minutes, the sun had gone down below the trees, and the land was ghostly quiet in the brief African dusk. Rosa went out onto the stoop, and hugging her arms across her chest at the chill of the evening, she stared out down the darkening length of the valley. She stood there, waiting restlessly, and as the day passed swiftly into darkness, so her mood changed from anticipation to a formless foreboding. Quietly, but with an edge to her voice, she called back into the room. "Light the lights, please, Nanny." Behind her, she heard the sound of metal on glass, then the flare of a sulphur match, and a feeble yellow square of light was thrown out onto the veranda to fall around her feet. The first puff of the night wind was cold on her bare arms. She felt the prickle of goose flesh, and she shivered unexpectedly.
"Come inside, little long hair," Nanny ordered. "The night is for mosquitoes and leopards, and other things."
But Rosa lingered, straining her eyes into the darkness, until she could no longer see the shape of the fig trees at the bottom of the lawn. Then abruptly she turned away and went into the bungalow. She closed the door and slid the bolt across. Later she woke. There was no moon outside and the room was dark. Beside her bed she could hear the soft, piglet sounds that little Maria made in her sleep. Again the disquieting mood of the early evening returned to her, and she lay still in her bed, waiting and listening in the utter blackness, and the darkness bore down upon her, so that she felt herself shrinking, receding, becoming remote from reality, small and lonely in the night. In fear, then, she lifted the mosquito netting and groped for the cradle. The baby whimpered as she lifted her and brought her into the bed beside her, but Rosa's arms quietened her, and soon she slept against the breast, and the warmth of the tiny body stilled Rosa's own agitation. The shouting woke her, and she opened her eyes with a surge of joy, for the shouts would be Sebastian's bearers. Before she was fully awake, she had thrown aside the bedclothes, struggled out from under the mosquito netting, and was standing in her nightdress with the baby clasped to her chest. It was then that she realized that the room was no longer in darkness. From the window into the yard, it was lit by a red-gold glow that flared and flickered and faded. The last tarnish of sleep was cleared from her brain, so she could hear that the shouts from outside were not those of welcome, and on a lower key there were other sounds, a whispering, rustling, and popping that she could not identify. She crossed to the window, moving slowly, with dread for what she might find, but before she reached it, a scream froze her. It came from the kitchen yard, a scream that quivered on the air long after it had ended, a scream of terror and of pain. "Merciful God!" she whispered, and forced herself to peer out. The servants' quarters and the outhouses were on fire. From the thatch of each, the flames stood up in writhing yellow columns, lighting the darkness. There were men in the yard, many men, and all of them wore the khaki uniform of German askari. Each of them carried a rifle, and the bayonet blades glittered in the glare of the flames. "They have crossed the river. No. Oh, please, God, no." And Rosa hugged the baby to her, crouching down below the windowsill. The scream rang out again, but weaker now, and she saw a knot of four askari crowded around something that squirmed in the dust of the yard. She heard their laughter. The excited laughter of men who kill for fun, as they stabbed down on the squirming thing with their bayonets. At that moment, another of the servants broke from the burning outbuildings and ran for the darkness beyond the circle of flames. Shouting again, the Ashkari left the dying man and chased the other. They turned him like a pack of trained greyhounds coursing a gazelle, laughing and shouting in their excitation, and drove him back into the daylight glare of the flames. Bewildered, surrounded, the servant stopped and looked wildly about him, his face convulsed with terror. Then the Ashkari swarmed over him, clubbing and hacking with their rifles.
"Oh, oh God, no!"
Rosa's whisper sobbed in her throat, but she could not drag her eyes away. Suddenly, in the uproar, she heard a new voice, a bull bellow of authority. She could not understand the words, for they were shouted in German, but from around the angle of the bungalow appeared a white man, a massive figure in the blue corduroy uniform of the German colonial service, with a slouch hat pulled low down on his head and a pistol brandished in one hand. From the description that Sebastian had given her, she recognized the German commissioner.
"Stop them!"
Rosa did not speak aloud. The appeal was in her mind only. "Please stop them burning and killing." The white man was railing at his Ashkari. His face turned towards where Rosa crouched, and she saw it was round and pink, like that of an overweight baby. In the firelight, it glistened with a fine sheen of sweat.
"Stop them. Please stop them," Rosa pleaded silently,
but under the commissioner's direction, three of the Ashkari ran to where, in the excitement of the chase, they had dropped their torches of dry grass. While they lit them from the flaming outbuildings, the other Ashkari left the corpses of the two servants and spread out in a circle around the bungalow, facing inwards, with their rifles held at high port. Most of the bayonets were dulled with blood.
"I want Finney and the Singese, not bearers and gun boys. I want the fight men. Burn them out," shouted Fleischer,
but Rosa recognized only her father's name. She wanted to cry out that he was not here, that it was only her and the child. The three Ashkari were running in towards the bungalow now. Sparks and fire streamed back from the torches they carried. In turn, each man checked his run, poised himself like a javelin thrower, then hurled the torch in a high, smoking arc towards the bungalow. Rosa heard them thump, thump onto the thatched roof above her head.
"I must get my baby away before the fire catches,"
and she hurried across the room out into the passage. It was dark here, and she groped along the wall until she found the entrance to the main room. At the front door she fumbled with the bolts and opened it a crack. Peering through to the firelit lawns beyond the stoop, she saw the dark forms of Ashkari waiting there also, and she drew back. "The side windows of the kitchen," she told herself. "They're closest to the bush. That's the best chance." And she stumbled back into the passage. Above her now, there was a sound like high wind and water, a rushing sound, blending with the crackle of burning thatch, and the first taint of smoke stung her nostrils.
"If only I can reach the bush," she whispered desperately,
and the child in her arms began to cry.
"Hush, my darling. Hush now."
But her voice was scratchy with fear. Maria seemed to sense it. Her petulant whimperings changed to lusty, high-pitched yells, and she struggled in Rosa's grasp. From the side windows of the kitchen, Rosa saw the familiar waiting figures of the Ashkari hovering at the edge of the firelight. She felt despair catch her stomach in a cold grip and squeeze the resolve from her. Suddenly her legs were weak under her, and her whole body was shaking. From within the bungalow, behind her, there came a thunderous roar as part of the burning roof collapsed. A blast of scalding air blew through the kitchen, and the tall columns of sparks and flames thrown up by the collapse lit the surroundings even more vividly. It showed another figure beyond the line of Ashkari, scampering in from the edge of the bush like a little black monkey, and Rosa heard Nanny's voice,
"Little long hair, little long hair,"
a plaintive ancient wail. Nanny had escaped into the bush during the first minutes of the attack. She had lain there, watching, until the roof of the bungalow fell in. Then she could no longer contain herself. Insensible of her own danger, caring for nothing except her previous charges, she was coming back. The Ashkari saw her also. Their rigid, well-spaced line crumpled as all of them ran to head her off. Suddenly, the ground between Rosa and the edge of the bush was clear. Now there was a chance, just the smallest chance, that she could get the child away. She flung the window open and dropped through it to the earth. One moment she hesitated and glanced towards the confusion of running men away on her right. In that moment, she saw one of the Ashkari catch up with the old woman and lunge forward with his bayonet. Nanny reeled from the force of the blow in her back. Involuntarily, her arms were flung wide open, and for a fleeting second, Rosa saw the point of the bayonet appear miraculously from the centre of her chest as it impaled her. Then Rosa was running towards the wall of bush and scrub 50 yards ahead of her, while Maria howled in her arms. The sound attracted the attention of the Ashkari. One of them shouted a warning, and then the whole pack was after her in full tongue. Rosa's senses were overwrought by her terror, so finely tuned that it seemed the passage of time was lagging. Weighed down by the child, each pace she took dragged on forever, as though she waded through waist-deep water. The long nightdress around her legs hampered her, and there was rough stone and thorn beneath her bare feet. The wall of bush ahead of her seemed to come no closer, and she ran with the cold hand of fear squeezing her chest and cramping her breathing. Then, into her line of vision from the side came a man, an Ashkari, a big man, bounding towards her with the long, loping gallop of a bull baboon, cutting across her line of flight, his open mouth an obscene pink pit in the shiny black of his face. Rosa screamed and swung away from him. Now she was running parallel to the edge of the bush, and behind her she heard the slap of feet upon the earth, closing fast, and the babbling chorus of the pursuit. A hand snatched at her shoulder, and she twisted away from it, feeling the stuff of her nightgown tear beneath the clutching fingers. Blind with terror, she stumbled a dozen paces back towards the burning homestead. She felt the vast waves of heat from it in her face and through her thin clothing, and then a rifle butt struck her in the small of the back, and a bright burst of agony paralyzed her legs. She dropped to her knees, still holding Maria. They ringed her in, a palisade of human bodies and gloating, blood-crazed faces. The big one who had felled her with the rifle butt stooped over her, and before she recognized his intention, he had snatched Maria from her arms and stepped back again. He stood laughing, holding the child by her ankles, letting her swing head downwards so her tiny face was suffused with blood, scarlet in the light of the flames.
"No, please, no!"
Rosa crawled painfully towards the man.
"Give her back to me! My baby, please give her back!"
And she lifted her arms towards him. The Ashkari dangled the child tantalizingly in front of her, retreating slowly as she crawled towards him. The others were laughing, hoarse, sensual laughter, crowding around her, faces contorted with enjoyment and polished ebony black with the sweat of excitement as they jostled each other for a better view of the sport. There was a wild yell. The Ashkari swung Maria high, whirled her twice above his head as he pivoted to face the bungalow and threw Maria up towards the burning roof. The tiny body flew with the looseness of a rag doll through the air. Her nightdress fluttered as she dropped and struck the roof, rolled awkwardly down the slope of it with her clothing blooming into instant flame, until she reached a weak spot in the burning thatch. It sucked Maria in like a fiery mouth and blew a belch of sparks as it swallowed her. At that instant, Rosa heard the voice of her child for the last time. It was a sound she was never to forget. For a moment, the men about her were hushed, and then, as though wind blew through trees, they moved a little with a sound that was a half sigh, half moan. Still kneeling, facing the burning building, which was now a pyre, Rosa slumped forward and lifted her hands to cover her face as though in prayer. The askari who had thrown the child snatched up his rifle from where it lay at his feet and stood over her. He lifted it above his head, the way a harpooner holds his steel with the point of the bayonet, aimed at the base of Rosa's neck, where her hair had fallen open to expose the pale skin. In the moment that the askari paused to take his aim, Hermann Fleischer shot him in the back of the head with his Luger.
"Mad dog!" the commissioner shouted at the askari's corpse. "I told you to take some alive!"
Then, breathing like an asthma case from the exertion of his run to intervene, he turned to Rosa.
"Fräulein, my apologies."
He doffed the slouch hat with ponderous courtesy and spoke in German that Rosa did not understand.
"We do not make war on women and babies."
She did not look up at him. She was crying quietly into her cupped hands.